How's it going, everybody? It's me, Kevin. Welcome to the Sega Night Kevin podcast. Today, I have in my possession, I captured for myself a PureFlix writer, someone who has written movies for PureFlix for years and years and years, and he agreed to come on my show and tell everything. Well, maybe not everything, but as much as he could tell within an hour. His name is Sean Paul Murphy, so I'm not going to delay any longer. Let's get right into it.
Now, the accountability partner no one asked for, Kevin McCreary. Here's Say Goodnight, Kevin.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Say Goodnight, Kevin podcast. This is such an exciting episode, an episode that I've actually recorded two times. This is the second time recording this episode. I think the first time we did this was at the when I first got started and I messed everything up in the audio. I might release it one day and you'll just hear an echo on my voice. This is a conversation with Sean Paul Murphy. Sean, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show here today.
Kevin, it's great to be here because I know I'm safe. I know you will never ask me any questions that would endanger my future in the Christian film business. I know I'm perfectly comfortable here and I'll be coddled.
Yes, yes. This is basically an interview with K-Love. I strive for that. Actually, I hope to work for K-Love or Air One or somebody one day. So I'm going to coddle every guest. Having said that, though, of course, there are a few things. Now, if people don't know who Sean Paul Murphy is, who wouldn't, right?
No one knows who the writers are, Kevin.
Right. If you were an actor, that's the people who get the attention, the big names. Those are the people who get to go to the Dove Awards.
Movie guides.
There you go.
I was there and was a 2012 winner of the $50,000 Kairos Prize.
Wow.
I didn't get all the money. I was actually second runner up.
I don't know that I watched it on TV that year.
They cut us out. They cut the writers out.
Well, at least, sort of the way
they cut Unplanned out this year, wasn't it?
See, you cut me off before I was able to make an abortion joke.
I'm sorry.
You beat
Those
me to
should
it.
Come fly fast and furious.
It's okay. Yeah, I saw that persecution shared on Twitter. So at least they've moved on to other people, you know. If people don't know, share some of the stuff that you've written. I know, but and I'm thinking actually of doing a Revelation Road trilogy series on my show coming up soon.
I can't wait. I would love to hear that.
Yeah. So that trilogy, that famed, probably to the level of Mad Max. Right?
Almost a ripoff even.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah.
So it's a post-apocalyptic Mad Max-esque movie starring David A.R. White.
That's almost Mel Gibson.
I mean, he is Mel Gibson to me.
Shorter.
He.
No, I think David's actually taller than Mel Gibson, probably.
Yeah. I was trying to think which one's more Christian.
I know David A.R. White pretty well, but I don't know Mel Gibson, so I can't make the comparison. I could guess, though, but I'm not going to.
I think David's had fewer leaked rants to his family members, or at least they didn't make the news.
Exactly.
Maybe they cut that part out. So,
you're never going to get David on this show.
It's never going to happen. I think I've accepted that, but maybe one day, maybe he'll be brave enough. That's what I consider it cowardice to not come on my show, even if they have no idea it exists.
Well, I came. This is my second time. And
I know.
I know how you treated me the first time.
Yeah.
So.
You're the bravest of them all. So for people who don't know, David White is one of the founders of PureFlix. He was the Pastor Dave in the series God's Not Dead. And you've worked with him a good bit. A lot of your scripts that you've written, he's been the star.
Yes. So, you know, we had a relationship like Robert Towne and Robert De Niro or something. No, it was, the guy who wrote Schrader and De Niro, like in Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of like David and my relationship.
And then who's Schrader. The Scorsese in that scenario?
Whoever they could get.
Whoever was down on their luck.
Well, Gabe Sabloff, the director of Revelation Road films is the Scorsese now. It was flavor of the month before then, romance. Yeah. who was ever to bromance at the time.
Tell me a little bit about how you got started writing. Like, do you grow up and you're like, you know what? I want to write Christian movies.
That's exactly what I thought. No, actually, it may surprise you, but that wasn't the way it was.
Huh.
You know, I liked writing. When I was in school, teachers liked my writing. It gave me attention that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise in high school. But of course, I went to an all-boys school, so that attention wasn't always good, you know, if you know what I mean. So,
Maybe.
Well, you wouldn't know school references anyway.
Yeah. I got plenty of attention and positive parental encouragement.
Positive feedback. Encouragement. Yeah. And I went to college. I love movies, but, you know, I lived in Baltimore. There was no precedent for someone in Baltimore writing movies that I was aware of. So, I was going to become a journalist. And I went to college and took journalism, Towson University, where I now teach screenwriting, at least one section a semester. And I went there, and I was doing fine in journalism until Professor Kim brought in some of his success stories, you know, students who had gone on and become professional journalists. And I was interviewing one who worked for the News American, which was a daily here in Baltimore. And I discovered I was making more money as a part-time busboy than he was making at the newspaper. And it was around that time that I decided that I was going to switch out of journalism. And I went into the film concentration of the mass communications degree. And I also, but I did take English minor concentration in writing. And I left that. I went, got a job in advertising. You know, it was tough to get that job there. You know, well, my mother worked there and got me the job.
Mm.
So that's how that happened.
That's okay. And nothing wrong with that.
And I worked in all the departments of the agency except account services, which deals directly with the clients. And I mentioned that to one of the partners once. I said, you know, I've worked in every department except account services. And he just looked at me and said, that was not an oversight, Sean. So apparently they did not feel my skills for dealing with the clients. And I ended up, although I wanted to be a writer, I ended up becoming a producer at the agency. And then, you know, in partnership with another producer who liked to go out into the field, you know, and go out into the shoots, I liked post-production. So I began specializing in the post-production. And eventually I left to become an editor and a screenwriter. My first, two of my first three screenplays got Hollywood attention. And like the fifth one I wrote got me a big, a big agent, a well-known agent known for breaking talent. And he, you know, it was Stu Robinson with Robinson, Weintraub, and Gross. And they merged, I believe, with some other places to form Paradigm, which is one of the big agencies in Hollywood. And he was getting me all sorts of great reads by A-listers. I believe my first script was that he handled, The Long Drive, was being pitched as a vehicle for Paul Newman and Tom Cruise, you know, because they had acted together in The Color of Money, and they were looking for a vehicle. And this was being pitched as that. So that's what kind of level I was getting early in my career. And, people like Richard Zanuck were reading my scripts and, you know, loving it and all. So, and then my agent died, you know, without taking my career into account, you know.
So selfish.
I know. He could have just held on another year or so.
Yeah.
Until I had been broken. But, you know, I did an independent film called 21 Eyes. In fact, I have the box here. I know it's a podcast. It's not a visual spot on.
Well, people can sign up for my subscription service, SGK Plus, and then they can see all the glory. So I might as well throw a plug there.
Yeah. So I did this film independently. And I love the film, and I still love it. It's probably, if I have to watch one of my movies, it would be that one, 21 Eyes. And I'm not disparaging all the others. Some of them, but not all of them. But
well, I hope you do soon.
Yeah. But
disparaging up to me. I'll get to it.
You know, I looked at the number of views and all it was getting when it was on social media and when it was on streaming and this and that. And I'm like, we signed such a bad deal for the movie. And I was like, I want to self-distribute a movie. So I decided to write a faith-based film. Actually, those first two scripts I told you got Hollywood attention were both very heavily faith-oriented,
mm-hmm.
which is, it's kind of surprising because no one even looked at it that way. One of them, the agent that was handling it for a while, was Jewish, and it was an end times thing. I could have been left behind before left behind. And he viewed it as an allegory about the Holocaust.
Mm.
And he says, I'm kind of nervous to handle this because, you know, I'm Jewish and I don't try to inject my faith much into the films, you know, into the projects I take. So he took it strictly as a Jew, you know, as a Jewish Holocaust.
That's interesting.
Allegory. So I wrote this film, I, John, and I decided, well, if I'm going to produce this film, I thought I'd be able to produce it for a decent budget, double the budget and promote it. You know, I thought I would do it, but I decided to watch a bunch of other Christian films to see what the competition was.
And when, what year was this?
This was about 2005, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't impressed, but, you know,
Mel Gibson, speaking of him, he wasn't Passion of the Christ out that year?
I'm talking independent, you know, type films.
You know, I heard a similar story that, I can't say who mentioned this, but apparently I should have the person I know see if they'll tell this story. But apparently Quentin Tarantino saw Passion of the Christ and it got him interested in Christian movies and was like, oh, I didn't realize that Christian movies were like this. There's this subgenre because he loves just watching movies, independent movies and stuff. So he dove in to look at some other Christian movies. And was sorely disappointed. He realized pretty quickly, oh, this isn't a hidden subgenre. That's awesome.
Well, the films that got me sort of into it, I saw The Moment After, which starred David A.R. White, mm-hmm. and, you know, Kevin Downs, and directed by Wes Llewellyn. And then I saw Six, The Mark Unleashed,
mm-hmm.
which strangely also starred David A.R. White.
And Kevin Downs.
And what I liked about those films, as opposed to some of the other ones, I'm not going to say who didn't like the Cristiano films or something, is that they actually were trying to tell thrillers, mm-hmm. and or, you know, more serious dramas. They were preachy, but they weren't like totally preachy.
Yeah.
So I decided, well, why am I going to do this alone? So I saw Bobby Downs was one of the producers of Six, The Mark Unleashed.
Yeah.
So I found his email. And I sent him an email saying, hey, I've got this script. I got this movie out already. I was handled by, you know, a major agency. And didn't hear back from him. But I got this letter from this guy, Dave White. And, that, mm-hmm. you know, without the AR. And he goes, sure. Hey, I'll read your script.
That was before he was an assault
rifle. Yeah, before he was an assault rifle. He's like, hey, I'll read your script. But there was a problem. I was pitching a horror movie at the same time to other people. And, you know, I keep meticulous records of who I pitched to. And I didn't pitch it to a guy named Dave White. So I'm like, excuse me, but what script was it? He's like, the Christian one? And he goes, well, what's the other one? I'll read that too. I'm like, okay. So I hear back from him about, you know, like days later. He calls me and he says he really liked the script, but he didn't want to do it. I said, why? He goes, well, you know, I'm doing these films with Kevin Downs, and we only want to do films that we can star in.
Sure.
And there was no roles for us in this movie. And he said, we want to do a Christian comedy. He goes, what we really liked about your script was it had a sense of humor. He goes, all the stuff we read, there's no sense of humor at all. And they said, we want to do a Christian comedy. And we were, a Christian big chill, but emphasis on the comedy. Want to know if you wanted to write it. And I go, well, if I write a comedy, I don't like to do it alone. I said, I have a friend of mine, Tim Radishak. I'd like to, if he's very funny, I'd like to bring him in on it. And so they're like, you can do what you want, but as long as we don't have to talk to him, you know? So that's, I'm like, okay. I called Tim. He didn't believe it, that there was an assignment coming.
Uh-huh.
And he says, let me think about it. I said, I'll give you half an hour. He called back and we ended up writing that movie, and that was the beginning. It wasn't even Pure Flix then. It was, I think it was called Signal Rock or something. And
Rock. Down
by the time it started, he had broken with Downs,
uh-huh.
Downs and all went off and did another company. I did like dandelion dust and things like that. David told me the reason was is that Kevin and Bobby wanted to do fewer but bigger budget movies. And David wanted just to do a bunch of movies starring him, you know.
Wow. Well, hey, they both have what they want.
Yeah.
Because Kevin Downs is producer of the two of the biggest Christian movies in the last few years, I can only imagine, and whatever the one that was supposed to make a lot of money this year.
But didn't
because of coronavirus.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
At least that's what they're... Nah, I don't want to make that. I do believe that... I could say this. I don't care. I'm guessing the movie would have done better. I'm talking, of course, about...
I still believe. Yes.
I do worry about that.
You still believe that, though, right?
Huh?
That it would make more... You still believe that
I
it would
still
have made
believe
more money?
That would have made a lot more money had coronavirus not happened. But I don't know that it would have made the amount of money that they were expecting. I don't know what they were expecting, but I mean, you can tell by the budget and the marketing what a movie kind of is expecting to make. I'm guessing they were hoping to make somewhere around $40 million, and
at
it's
least.
Not going to make that. You know, I don't know a lot about numbers, but I do know that it's not going to make that. But they do have a built-in excuse that they can give to Lionsgate that, you know, hey, Corona. I think that's going to secure their future endeavors. So,
I believe they say they wanted to make multiple films a year.
Oh, yeah. And that's public knowledge. Their Kingdom Stories, the Irwin brothers, they have a big commercial on their YouTube channel. That's like, we are not just filmmakers, we're storytellers, and we're changing the Christian music movie industry, and what our movie success means your success. All this stuff.
That's so sweet. I'm so happy for us.
Yeah, don't you feel... See, how much did you lose whenever their I Still Believe didn't do well?
I lost everything.
Yeah. And it had
that's why
it done
I'm not
well,
wearing any pants.
You would have gained everything. I'm not wearing pants either. Perfect. But
that's the great thing about these Corona interviews.
Yeah, people have to sign up for SGK Plus if they want to see the pantsless interview. I've got a list here of three times I need to promote my subscription thing.
I signed up for the SG Planet, whatever.
Oh, good.
I didn't become a Patreon.
But that's fine. I'm not going to hold that against you. What I do appreciate about what you have to say is just you give me some insight on how kind of the behind the scenes from your perspective went on with these types of things. So that's
well,
funny
I will
to me.
Say in the and beginning, I was a real believer.
Yeah.
In the genre. You know, I really believed in the genre. I really believed we were doing good things. I really believed people had good motives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really believed in all those things. And, you know, I know I'm running across, people contact me all the time because they see the movies, particularly screenwriters. So I talk to them. People, you know, I'm pretty active on social media, other than Instagram, which regrettably I'm not that active on. But, you know, people are constantly contacting me. And a lot of them start off as like, all they want to do is Christian films. But I was never that person.
Yeah.
You know, even when I wrote a strictly secular film, oftentimes a perspective will come through because, you know, if you're writing a well-developed character, they should be like completely rounded. And even if they're not quote unquote religious, you got to have some sort of sense of their worldview and things like that.
Sure.
So, you know, I think most characters in films today are so shallow because they just seem to function for the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're trying to save their marriage or a kid or something like that, some sort of deed. But, you know, they are not whole people. And I'm not saying if you're looking at my Christian films, you're not going to say, wow, those are completely rounded whole characters either. You know, not that, you know, and I'm to blame for some of it, but not all.
Well, that's what I find interesting because I do think that you have a great understanding of writing, and I don't know that you have to make excuses to say like, well, guys, I do know what I'm talking about, but don't look at my movies. But what, because I've heard you talk about writing, and but what is it that you've ran into? What stops a movie from like if you feel a script is good, what happens? What in your experience has happened to go from a good script to a bad movie?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's funny because one of my proteges was potentially having a deal made for one of her films, and it was going to the investor, and the investor was making all sorts of story changes and everything. And she was like, why is it, you know, it's like, this guy never went to film school. He never read any books about screenplays. Mm-hmm. It's like, why does he get to make, he doesn't know anything about storytelling. Why does he get to make all of these changes?
Yeah.
I go, because he has the money.
Yes.
And also, and I'll tell you why Christian.
Sometimes their kids get to make changes.
Yeah. Sometimes like, hey, their girlfriends or mistresses.
I showed the script to my wife and my mistress. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they think that there needs to be more circus animals.
Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of it does come down to that. But also, you're really handcuffed. And everyone keeps telling me the Christian films are different now. They're not really. They're still the same as when I started.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you're really handcuffed by the fact that they've got to be, quote unquote, family friendly. So which limits what you can honestly deal with.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't show the world. You really can't show the world as it is. And my argument is, if you can't show the world, if you can't show the world as it is, then our solution isn't going to seem real either. It's going to seem as fake as our world. You know, so, and that's why I ultimately began to believe that the films don't work as evangelism, because only Christians are seeing them, because they're so fake and phony because the people aren't real in them. And, you know, even Christians, you know, when I was starting, I'd ask anybody, anytime I'd visit a new church, you listen to Christian music. Oh yeah, I love it. Love it. Love it. Do you watch Christian movies? No. Why? They're so fake, you know, and these are Christians, you know,
now, so what is it about them that makes them fake? Like I have my speculations, but for you, what makes so many Christian movies so fake?
A lack of realism, you know, because
now what is that?
Can only show,
people will say, oh yeah, we need to make this real. We need to have the F word and we need to have blood and guts and, you know, things that we all see every day, apparently.
Exactly. That does not make it real. But in the case of my book coming out, if someone was actually watching instead of hearing, Chapel Street, you know, it's not a Christian book. It deals with the Christian world. You know, it definitely has strong Christian themes in it. But one person who is reading it, who's like a fan of mine, who has a webpage, he just sent me an email. He must have just started and said, is this book have a Christian worldview? Because it's not telegraphed right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you know, our movies are made to comfort an audience. You know, they're made to make people feel good about themselves. And if you look at it, the thing about art, all great art challenges the viewer or challenges the audience. And our films don't challenge the audience. You know, we don't hold a reflection up to ourselves. As Christians, we hold a reflection up to the world. And essentially what we're saying is like that Pharisee, and I forgot which gospel, it says, oh, I am so glad I am not like these sinners. You know, that's what we're showing. But then we don't even get to show the sin either. Like in Hidden Secrets, my first film for David A.R. White, his character, I think was named David too, to make it easy to remember.
That's weird. Because he's David in the God's Not Dead movies, or he's Dave. And then isn't his last name White?
I'm not sure. I only saw those once for a
legal reasons. in your movie Brother White, is his last name White?
Yeah, his name is White.
Okay.
You know, so but in
like Andy Griffith, I guess.
Yeah. in Hidden Secrets, he's a guy that has like sleeping around. He's got a sexual problem.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they toned it down to not to offend anyone that when he comes time for his big confessions, he's like, here's what he says. He goes, I've done things I've regretted. I've given in to the flesh. And I'm like, when I hear that, I'm like, David, what are you talking about? That's like me eating a thing of Haagen-Dazs. You know, I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say who, but here's a perfect example. Somebody else told me about this movie. I'm not going to name the movie, but the writer was, they were a big church, I believe in like Brazil or somewhere, felt like adultery was a huge problem in our culture. So they wanted to make a movie about adultery. But then they decided that it would be sinful to depict adultery.
Sure.
So they decided to make it a film about people having an emotional affair. You know, so that's what they ended up
making. So they're not even referencing it.
Exactly. So in other words, as not to appear, you know, to, you know, to have the appearance of sin, they decide really not to make a movie about the thing that so troubled them that they were going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to make something about.
Well, that's like the Fireproof. It's confusing because you don't actually know. Like, unless you know, and then you are, you know, it's like the opposite of Jaws, where in Jaws, you don't see the thing. And so it fills your mind and it makes it scarier. Well, when he's smashing his computer or clicking around on the internet, I'm like, well, we know what he's looking at. And it, now I'm filling in the gaps. Who knows what, with something far worse that they're probably talking about. Not that they need to show it. And then with his wife in that movie, I have people comment on my video, and I'd have to watch. Sometimes when I edit my reviews, I have to cut it down. So sometimes I leave stuff out that I don't think are important, and then maybe some viewers misunderstand what happens. But they were like, they thought that she had had an affair. But in the movie, I think it implies that she didn't have an affair, but it leaves it so obscure and ambiguous that you're kind of like, what happened here?
Well, obviously, she did things she was not proud of and had given into the flesh.
That's true.
Basically, here's the rule of thumb, and I think it still stands, is that you're not allowed to show in a Christian movie something that a pastor wouldn't feel comfortable showing in his sanctuary.
Because that they need it as a preaching tool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, so it seems like the things that hold Christian movies back are what someone might say, the email they might get from Karen or the investor that knows nothing about telling a story in movies and has a particular, like, I want to invest in a movie that does this.
Yeah.
That is not entertain, but does this as in tells people about a thing that I want them to know about. Would that be a correct analysis?
I would also say that in Christian films, like horror films, well, not the bigger budget horror films, but in low-budget horror films, it's also the problem of one-man bands, you know, people writing, producing, directing, and starring in their own movies, you know. And that's what irritated me most about Christian films, because everything's for the Lord. Well, it's like, then everything should be the best it can be. And it's like, if you have a budget that you can actually get a known actor, and it is true, the bigger the actors in the film, you know, the more people will come and see it, but you choose to star in it yourself, then it's not really about reaching people for the Lord. It's about your ego.
Yeah. Do you, so
it, I'm not saying I ever worked with anyone like that.
Well, I think people could put it together that perhaps you did.
Well, you're connecting those dots.
Yeah, that's something I do from time to time. Tell me a little bit about some of those encounters.
Ooh, did you just mention one of my films?
That was a good one, huh?
Well, here's the perfect example of how I wrote a blog about it in my writing blog called Cross Purposes, how people with different goals will destroy a movie. So there was a film, a little film I did called The Encounter. It was actually the cheapest film I've ever done, you know, other than like one or two little shorts that we did ourselves. But you know, it got huge. You know, it's funny. It was the redheaded stepchild, and sorry for any redheaded stepchilds out there, of PureFlix, because they were pouring all their money into Jerusalem Countdown. And The Encounter was sort of like an afterthought. But The Encounter, you know, Jerusalem Countdown's forgotten. The Encounter has just lived on.
It was
They had no publicity.
It was the Lion King of PureFlix.
It really is. It didn't make up until God's Not Dead, it was their most profitable film.
Really?
So they immediately had to make a sequel. But if you notice one thing about the movie, there was a big problem with the movie, The Encounter. Most people didn't realize it. David White was only in at the very end in a little cameo.
Like, that is a problem.
At the end titles. So he was the big star of Jerusalem Countdown. That film did nothing. So originally when they were talking about a sequel, because this was a film, this was finally a film that was doing what I hoped it would do, really reach people. You know, when it first played, it premiered at the Boston Film Festival, which was a Boston Christian Film Festival. Hey, invite your friend, your unsaved friend out to the movies. And it was pretty successful. And 200 people came forward to accept the Lord after that movie. You know, so that was really amazing. And it was really humbling, too. And I know it was 200 because I counted, you know, so it isn't like I was like about the numbers, but I did count. So I guess that makes me sinful. So, you know, because that film had such a, you know, I hate to use the term anointing on it, there was going to be a sequel immediately. And we're like, oh, we should make it about, we should reach who would be the best people to make a film for. And it would be high school students. So it was going to be, because it was a pure flicks movie, it had to be a ripoff of something that already existed. You know, so they were going to do a Breakfast Club, you know, so we were going to do it, you know, all the archetypical college, high school students. And then guess who's going to moderate the breakfast? You know, the detention thing. Jesus, you know, and I tell you, it was already, I already had the themes ready to go. I was finally going to answer and resolve, you know, faith versus science in there.
Oh, you were going to you were going to do it.
Yeah, but since the movie didn't happen, we're going to have to continue to have that debate.
Well, God's not dead.
I'm not going to put it out for free. Oh, I don't think that really answered as well as I would have. So that's what we were going to go, a film that would actually speak and be happy for the audience. But there was a problem.
David.
You know, if with a bunch of high school students, Dave couldn't play one of the high school students.
He could play Jesus.
No, Bruce Marciano had already taken that role.
Oh, which meant he's typically Jesus in these movies, right?
And even when he's not Jesus, he's Jesus in them. But he's usually Jesus in them. You know,
that's
so
funny.
Bruce's ministry as Jesus had lasted longer than Jesus's ministry as Jesus. You know, no offense to Bruce. He's a fine man.
I'm sure.
But,
yes.
Truth.
No, that's a great joke. I love that.
So here, but no, here's how
yes.
Change. So we're doing a sequel to a thing about Breakfast Club, you know, ripoff, because we want to have an evangelical message to high school students. But because the film was so successful and he wasn't in the first one, he had to be in the second one. So Breakfast Club is out the window. And then because he was positioned, apparently he had gotten a new agent. And I got emails for all this, so I don't care if he's mad. If he tries to sue me, I kept all my emails, David, and you wouldn't want them to see the light of day. So,
see, this is why I have you on the podcast. These are the things I want to hear. This is beautiful.
David said the movie had to revolve around him in an action role.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to play either a criminal or a corrupt cop. Forget those kids. Forget about answering the conflict between science and faith. You know, now we were doing a ripoff of Desperate Hours, the Humphrey Bogart film.
Okay.
Where basically he holds people hostage, and one of the people he holds hostage happens to be Jesus.
Oh, Jesus. I thought you were going to say a Christian. Okay.
No. Yes, no. A Christian, very much so.
That would actually be not extremely on the nose.
Yeah. So we're writing this and it was going to be set in California. However, one of the producers, a couple of the people on the Pure Flix team, had been helping produce a number of films in Southeast Asia, Thailand. And some of them had girlfriends in Thailand.
Oh.
And I'm not insinuating anything bad. I believe one of them married a woman from Asia.
Okay. I thought you meant like girlfriends.
Oh,
in addition to their wives, yeah.
No,
okay.
I would never intimate anything like that. So we had to throw that script out because now, so that the people could go back to Southeast Asia on an investor's dime, the film had to be set in Thailand. So that's how a little film about Jesus meeting people in the diner, which was going to have a sequel about Jesus talking to some high school students, became a film about David A.R. White as a as a corrupt cop chasing a drug dealer in Thailand.
Uh-huh. So that movie never got made, though?
Yes.
Oh, it did.
It was called The Encounter Paradise Lost.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know. You know, people, when I talk about Christian movies, something like God's Not Dead 3, even filmmakers, they're like, that's a movie that got made? Yeah. I feel like the guy who knows too much about all this stuff. But then I talk to you, and I feel so out of the loop.
That one came out on Blu-ray.
What?
No, I think it was, wait a second, just to prove it to you, here it is.
There it is.
Look, that's Jesus in the middle.
Yes.
Who is that fellow? Do you not recognize him?
I've seen him before.
Yes.
So how did that one do? As well as the first one?
No, considerably less well than the first one.
Even
but
they
do have they do have a series on pureflix.com.
So you wrote that one as well, the Encounter 2.
Yes. Well, the first one I wrote with Tim, but by when the Encounter 2 came up, Tim had quit Pureflix, but he came back. So I wrote Encounter 2 without him. Actually, when he came back, we were getting paid the same amount of money to write a script. We were getting the same for a script. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of like, we should stop writing them together and just double our salaries.
There you go.
You know, so, so Encounter 2 was not, but you know what? As strange as it may sound, it really reached some people. Yeah. And like now I have a guy, a friend who is helped bring down the, Columbo family and, in New York, the Mafia family. And he reached out to me because he saw that movie.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, so it has, I've heard people say good things about it, but someone was criticizing the drug dealing aspect of it, saying that the writer didn't know anything about it. Boy, I wanted to get that guy and say, hey, I'm from Baltimore, man.
Yeah.
You know, but it was about drug smuggling, not necessarily about the kind of street drug dealing that people know.
Like maybe for this small-time independent film, you should have gone deeper undercover in the drug dealing arena to find out more.
Well, we had the guy Milano who played Sonny Red and Donnie Brasco. He was great to have in this film. You know, it was really kind of an oddball, strange film.
Yeah.
You know,
and so when you're asked to write a movie like this, what do they give you? Like, what kind of rules do they give you to follow? What kind of like
sequel? To Encounter.
I know, but you...
David White stars in it. David White's an action star. Must be filmed in Thailand.
Did you write the high school one? The Breakfast Club one?
No, we were starting it. Somebody else later wrote that one, but it was never produced as a feature.
Okay. So you didn't write a script and you're like, here it is. And they're like, nah, it's that one. You're still working on that?
No, they basically... they knew that wasn't going to happen because there was no role for the right people in it.
Okay. Man, so no movies. But God's Not Dead didn't star David White.
No, it didn't.
At first. So they have a movie that comes out. They didn't know it was going to do well, but then it does. And then
they knew that they bet the farm on God's Not Dead.
Yeah.
I was still in it enough at that point to know that.
In
basically,
what way?
What?
In what way?
I was still associated with them enough.
But I mean, what do you mean by they bet the farm?
I spent $1 million. It says $2 million, but I believe the budget was $1 million. I could be wrong because everything says $2 million. Then again, some of my films I made, if you look on the IMDb, it says it has $1 million budget. And I'm like, really? $60,000.
Yeah, that's something I've learned from directors writing to me. They always are like, no, you're
so,
wrong.
But here's what I meant by they bet the farm.
Yeah.
They were raising $5 million in P&A, you know, in prints and advertising. And what they put up for collateral was the company. If they didn't return that $5 million, the investors got the company. That's the way it was explained to me because they were asked, I have brought investors to Pureflix in the past. And I brought a giant investor with them in once because I didn't have anything ready to go myself. But there was a guy who had friends who I helped out on something. And he's like, I know people and they want to get into the Christian media business. I'm like, okay. And I called at that time Russ, you know, Russ Wolf. And I said, hey, you would talk to this guy? Oh yeah, definitely. And they like pitched him to do like 4 or 5 movies for like $1 million budget or like $2 million budget. And I heard they turned them down. And I later talked to the guy that was the go-between with me and go, why'd they turn them down? He goes, they didn't ask for enough money. They wanted to invest like $50 to $60 million.
Wow. And they could have gotten more.
Yeah.
But they didn't ask for it.
So essentially what David told me, because he was asking me, do you know anybody? And I got the package. I still have it here somewhere, you know, about, you know, their expectations and all, is basically they were going to give them the company. And they did this, you know, so I'm not highly critical of them because they did it at the right time because the DVD market was the lifeblood, you know, and it wasn't very profitable anyway, because essentially I think the company lived off their production fees. When they would make a movie, the investors would provide all the money. They would siphon off a certain amount as a production fee to make the movie. And I think that's essentially the company money. And therefore, it also meant that the movies didn't have to make money. But if they made money, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, so the investors weren't expecting.
Some investors, some people do it. There's a lot of I feel really guilty if I get someone to invest in a movie and it doesn't make money.
Sure.
I'm pretty lucky.
Yeah, I would too.
I've gotten like half of the people I've gotten to, and I didn't get all of them. Like my first film, 21 Eyes, ultimately didn't make a project, but the people involved, it was profitable to them because they needed a loss and they wanted to do it. They wanted to make a movie. But if people really
like they need for tax purposes.
Well, they it was good for them for tax purposes, but they also wanted to make a movie. Mm-hmm. So it isn't like, even though the film wasn't profitable, it was profitable in other ways for them. But I feel bad, especially if it's someone I know, I'm going to have to face them. And it's sort of like, hey, do you think we're going to see another check? Do you think it's ever going to get into things? So I don't really feel comfortable.
And you should. Like, to me, if you're making something, you're taking, I'm not saying you in particular should feel bad, but.
Well, maybe I should.
That kind of pressure is what keeps Hollywood movies good, is the pressure that, hey, there's a lot of money on the line here. You better make a good movie.
Yeah.
I do wonder, and you would know more, if that's part of what prevents Christian movies from improving, is this kind of idea that, well, if it reaches one person, then it was all worth it. Like, are there a lot of investors like that who they're like, look at it more as a donation?
Yes. I'll say like Sarah's Choice, the original investor, saw a abortion activist on like Larry King, which is how old that was. And he felt that the abortion activist was saying a lot, was misrepresenting things and putting a lot of falsehoods. So he called Pure Flix and said, I want to make a movie about abortion. And he wanted to do like a point counterpoint, like the old 60 Minutes thing, you know, and these two people have you know, their opinions change on it. But, you know, Tim and I are like, yeah, that sounds terrible. So we came up with the thing that became Sarah's Choice. And the investor was fine because it was making the point he wanted to make. But here's a perfect case to illustrate, I think, what you're talking about. You know, I hope it doesn't just make someone want to kill me somewhere. But the first edit
of
Sarah's...
Well, if they do try to kill you, you got to come back on the podcast.
Okay, I certainly will. So the director held on to the film for a very long time. The director had first cut. Held on to it very close to the release, then handed it to Pure Flix. You know, he sent us a scene like right after the shooting was done, and the scene was very nice. So I'm like, oh, this is going to be a good movie.
And what movie
and,
is this?
What?
Which movie is this?
Sarah's Choice, starring Rebecca St. James.
Yes, that's right. Okay. You'd mentioned a few movies, so I had to make sure.
Yeah. So on this one, eventually he sent an edit to Pure Flix. And I get an email from David White, and he's like, John, I want you to see the movie. He sent me a file.
He's like, I'm not.
And
in
I said, what do you think? He goes, I couldn't watch it all the way through. And his wife, Andrea, who's like the second lead in the film, couldn't watch it all the way through. And I believe I heard that Rebecca St. James got a copy of it and she couldn't watch it all the way through. I believe only Russ Wolf, who was the supervising producer, watched the film all the way through, you know, and Tim and I were both excited about this film. Because, you know, we wanted to make a statement. We thought this had a chance to be a good movie. So I downloaded to make a DVD so we could watch it on the big screen. He came over to my house. We sat on the sofa. My wife sat beside us taking notes. And she said she never heard so much profanity out of my mouth as we watched this film. Because it was terrible. It really, really sucked. It was badly edited. And I was aghast, and I sent like 5 pages of notes, and but they did. They were going to release it as it is. And I forgot who, and I really did forget this. I know I've mentioned this before in other podcasts, but somebody told me, I said, we can't put this movie out. And they said, it's a pro-life film starring Rebecca St. James. It's going to sell the same number of copies, whether it's good or whether it's bad.
Mm. Ooh,
but
that hurts me deep down. I hate that because it's true. I know that that's probably true. And that's, to me, what I want to communicate to people is, hey, not that this is good or bad, but this is what you're buying. If people are thinking that behind the scenes, like, well, like it's chicken or the egg. It's like, well, they've seen this is what audiences are willing to pay for, and this is why they're willing to pay for it. But it's sad that they are in that place to do that, to think that.
Well, you know, fortunately, I think this had a happy ending because I am an editor by profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked if I could re-edit it.
Yeah.
And they gave me 1 week to re-edit the film because I knew there was a good film there because I was evaluating the performances. The performances were fine. It just needed to be edited differently. And I'm proud of that film now. They gave me 1 week to edit it. They actually paid me. They paid me less than what I normally make a day on editing other stuff. But they did give me some money.
Yeah.
So
I respect that. That I feel like that's something I would do. As much as I criticize movies, when I'm doing work and stuff, and if I really believe in something, you know, not that I think, oh, this is going to be the greatest thing ever, but I will take extra time because I want, like, nobody else has a vision for this, but I see the vision. I will. I don't know. I get that. That makes a lot of sense. I do work doing editing. I'm an editor myself as well, and to me, sometimes I'll get into a project and I may be even getting pushback from the client, but I just creatively I want to see something that's good. It doesn't have to be great in terms of, you know, if I'm working with content that isn't awesome, but like if I can see, especially editing, I want to see it through.
Yeah, I will say that on some of my, I didn't edit a lot of the films that I wrote. But on like Marriage Retreat, Tim Radishak and I wrote that script, and it was rewritten by Tommy Blaze and the director. And the director's done other films, but he took his name off this one, you know, so that's not his real name on that film. But in many ways, the script changed so much from what Tim and I wrote. If you were to go to timradishak.com and look at his list of films, I don't think he includes it. At least he didn't earlier. You know, he doesn't include that on the official canon. But I feel I made a more of a contribution to that film as an editor than as a writer.
Yeah.
Because I was getting reports while they were shooting this up on some mountain resort how horrible the movie was. They're like, oh my God, this is terrible. This is terrible. This is terrible. You know? And when I got it, it was, I think I managed to find the right tone for it. I'm not saying it's a great film. There was one horrible scene in particular where I emailed people and said, who wrote this scene? I can't believe how bad this scene is. I wanted to cut it out of the movie because I felt it stopped it dead in the tracks.
Yeah.
But no one would own up to writing it.
It's Alan Smitty.
Alan Smitty wrote it. Wrote it. He normally directs, but this time he jumped in.
He tried his hand at some writing.
Yeah. So, you say that that's terrible that they're looking at it like dollars and cents, but if you look at, go on any place where there's Christian films or sold where you can leave comments, and you'll see that the audience is evaluating the film almost entirely by the message.
Right. Correct. And that's why I say it's a chicken and egg situation, because I don't think it's terrible that they're doing that necessarily. It's just that's the feedback they've gotten from their audience. And that's why I look at what I do here as communicating to the audience. Here on the podcast or on my reviews, it's the same as an Amazon review. I just want people to think a little bit and think, you know what? If I want better movies, then I'm going to have to like better movies. I'm going to have to see better movies. I'm going to have to not give a movie an excuse, whether it's a political agenda that I like or a faith agenda that I like. That's not making those movies better. By having a bad movie that has a message you like it's representing your faith in a way that tells people, like you said at the beginning, people look and say, oh yeah, Christian movies, they're pretty boring or they're pretty cheesy or whatever. Like, that's a pretty common perception of Christian movies. And it's not because Christians aren't good at making movies. It's because Christians aren't good at watching movies.
That is a very good point. And I wrote a blog, my most popular blog. It's always at number one on my list of popular blogs. I have the bottom of my blog. And it's called Building the Faith-Based Ghetto, where I really examine and give you an insider's view, as it were, of, you know, and an unvarnished view of, like, why are we making these films? And it's advice to filmmakers. It's like, if you're a Christian filmmaker, you have three options. You can make film, you know, if you want to be a Christian filmmaker, you can either make films and express your faith, evangelical films, which in that case, if you're really reaching for the real people that you're trying to reach, it has to be honest and show the world. It's like, you know, the big example I always give is I was approached to write this film about a drug addict who becomes a Christian. And she was reasonably well known at the time because she was appearing on all these Christian talk shows talking about her experience. And it was a very harrowing experience and very dark. And they wanted to show that because they wanted to show the truth so that these people would know that, yes, even you, we know where you're coming from. And they wanted to have an unvarnished movie. And I'm like, that's great. And they're like, well, and the good thing is Christians. I'm like, no, Christians will not see that movie. Mm-mm. You know, they will not see a movie where there's a needle injected or a woman is reduced to prostitution, you know, and where there's where there's dangerous, mentally unbalanced people.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, well, what do you do? And I told them what you have to do is the audience that you're aiming for, you're making evangelical films, is different than the Christian audience, because the Christian audience wants, family friendly movies.
Right.
That essentially challenge, you know, the world, but not them. And I call that Christian entertainment. You're essentially making Christian entertainment, you know. And then I view that you should just be a mainstream, or you could just be a mainstream filmmaker and hope, you know, that, you know, your values will come through the films you make. And, you know, even if you're not heavy-handed about it, you know, because something rubs off whenever you create something. Sure. You can't write 120 pages without some of you coming through. You know,
yeah, and so, Christians understand that when talking about like a Harry Potter movie, I'm generalizing here, but it is. Do you feel like as a writer, like where do you get to be creative?
Most of my Christian films were written on assignment.
Yes,
you know, and often I am not these people that are there, but what I look for is something that's emotionally true for me, and I mean, what I write in there is spiritually true. You know, I don't believe in any way I'm misleading people.
Sure.
At least not in the original draft. You know, the film may become misleading later, but not with me.
But how do you keep doing that?
And what I discovered about the films is that whenever I close my eyes and my wife just kicked me. So, oh, no, she's saying I was interrupting you. But
oh, no, I was interrupting you.
Yeah, sorry. Please kick Kevin, please. Devin.
Yeah.
no. So what I found out is the more personal I made it about my life and my journey, those were the moments that resonated more deeply with the audience.
But does that make it harder to take when then a producer takes something that resonates with you?
Well, I'm sort of in that process now.
Yeah.
In a sense, my biggest film is it's going out to actors now. There's already money in place. It's that one I sent to David White, I, John, back in 2005 that won the Kairos Prize. And it's a spec script. And it's a very delicate script, but it's being rewritten. So I don't know what it's going to be in the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may be something I'm proud of, and I hope it is. I have my fingers crossed. You know, there are some things I disagree with. And I think some of the people in the production company agree with me, but we don't know how it's going to end up. And if it gets the right cast and the script is good, it's going to be very delicate to pull off because the subject matter is somewhat controversial. So
now, whenever you have that happen, do you feel, you said you're an author as well, you write books. Do you ever feel the desire to write like a novelization of a script that is more from your perspective or your vision of the story?
No, not that. We were, Tim and I had the chance, but we blew the opportunity to write the novelization of Sarah's Choice. No, I don't want to write the novelization. What I've decided is I'm really not trying to write any spec scripts that I care about unless I write a novel first.
Yeah.
That gives me leverage. Like right now in July 3rd, I have a novel coming out. Man, this is going to sound like a pitch.
That's okay.
But I have a novel coming, like a plug. I have a novel coming out called Chapel Street. And there have been a number of companies expressing interest in the book. And I'm certainly will be pitching it more. I'm waiting for the reviews to come out. But, you know, I think it'd make a great movie. But if it's a book and it's successful, they're going to make fewer changes with it. And this book is extreme. In a sense, this book is as personal. I had previously written a memoir called The Promise or The Pros and Cons of Talking to God, which is obviously my story.
That's great.
And I never wanted to make it as a movie. Some one or two companies did ask to see the book from the publisher. Mm-hmm. And I dreaded that because it's my story. And I knew what it would take to make it as a movie. You'd have to compress characters, time, this and that.
Sure.
And it's about real people. And it's sort of like, I was very, circumspect. That fact and what I wrote, and I wouldn't want to change it to make it work as a movie because books are different than movies.
Sure.
But Chapel Street would work really well, and it to me it's almost as personal. You know, it's a horror novel, it's a paranormal thriller, but I don't know if you've been following my blogs, but I grew up in a haunted house, and this was the writing this novel. I wrote it because I had two siblings who killed themselves. And my mother asked, we grew up in a haunted house, whether I thought that the entity in the house was in part responsible for the deaths of my siblings. And I had been wondering that myself because it was a very active demonic presence. And so I kind of wrote this novel as a way to sort of work through my feelings on it. It's very exaggerated, but there's a lot of stuff that's true. And I let my family read it. My sister recognized the truth under it and said it was like a cartoon version of the real events. And she's like, it was about time that we never talked about the haunting because we felt talking about the entity empowered it. And also we felt that it would follow you. Like if I was here at the height of the haunting, if I'm sitting in my house here talking about it, it could show up here, but we decided because I wrote the novel to actually start talking about it. I'm writing a series of blogs about it. I'm 21 blogs in.
Now you brought it to my podcast. Great.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
Well, suddenly if evil things start happening, you'll know why.
No. Fortunately, I don't believe any of that stuff, so I'm safe.
Oh, really? You don't believe the Bible about things like demons and things
Look,
like that?
I don't. I'm hesitant to say too much since you've had such a close and personal experience with mm-hmm. the situation.
Read my blogs.
I think that to a degree. I'm not as afraid of it because I don't think I'm supposed to be. If God's real, then he's probably more powerful. What's going to happen? I'm going to die probably one day.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because that's what my pastor was telling my wife because she was worried about when I started writing these that I could bring it down on us. And he's like, well, these things don't have much power anyway. And that reassured my wife. But then I'm sitting there thinking, well, it killed my two siblings.
Yeah.
and probably my father.
Yeah. So what kind of did you like go to a church where that was like, how did you know?
We were just Catholic. All this really dark, evil stuff started happening.
Yeah.
It was physically manifesting itself,
In what way?
In
what way? I'm sorry. I know that sounds sarcastic.
It would like physically appear to people.
Yeah.
It would speak to people. It would speak in mimicked voices.
Yeah.
It would move things. It would move furniture. It would take things and then put it elsewhere or just put it same back where it was earlier,
Yeah.
It would get into bed with people.
Yeah.
It would drive people to suicide. It would physically pick people up and throw them. It would do that kind of stuff.
Wow. Well, there we go. Well, if that starts happening, especially to me, people will know it's real because I'm not going to say it's real if I don't think it is.
Tell them why you weren't going to say it.
But I don't worry about that.
Oh, and also we didn't want to talk about it because we didn't want people to think we were crazy.
Yeah.
But really.
Well, too late.
Kevin, just for you. Just for you, Kevin. I put up a blog, I think it's two blogs ago, called Recap. you know, Haunting at 21 St. Helens Avenue, recap part one. That'll give you a taste of what was going on. And yeah. It's a lot of YouTube clips because I interviewed a lot of people about it.
That's cool.
Well, not a lot, only six so far, but I got a number of other people to interview.
I find that stuff fascinating. And they tell their stories. Because I've never, and I'm not one to, well, I've never experienced it, so I don't believe it. But I've never experienced it, so I don't believe it.
Well, I tell you what, Kevin, I only believe in one haunting, and that's the one I was through.
Yeah.
I'm skeptical of all other ones.
Yeah.
Especially if they say things that didn't sound like what happened to us.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, I'm pretty adamant on my reviews of these movies where the kids say that they died and went to heaven, and I'm like, but if it isn't true, how does that change anything? You know, in those particular situations, my faith in Jesus has nothing to do with my faith that a little kid is telling the truth or not.
Yeah.
And so it could be true, but if it's not true, I don't need it. I don't need it to be true for it to be true. And I'm not sure to what degree God needs it to be true. What's the point? So,
well, what's the point of any Christian entertainment then?
Exactly.
Oh, man, you just deflated everything. You just destroyed all of our work, Kevin.
I broke the industry.
You broke the Christian entertainment complex.
Well, I don't.
Well, I mean, the whole point of the movies, like, you know, these heaven tourism films, mm-hmm. is to be inspire people, you know. But the whole thing, you are right. If it's that's like this I, John film, you know, people. I think the big problem I have with one of the producers is he's looking at it as a contemporary Christian drama.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, it's not a drama. It's a fantasy.
Yes. So, yeah, that's so the rules thing don't, that I think it
the
gets
rules
lost
of drama don't apply.
That gets lost a lot in those types of movies because it's one thing to have Star Wars, but there's no altar call at the end of Star Wars. There may be influences of Buddhism and some Christianity and different like weird George Lucas religion stuff, but there's no call to action in terms of text your friends and tell them that the Force is real, except when it comes to marketing. They understand that when they put the Force be with you on a McDonald's cup, it isn't actually calling people to join the Force religion. It's all part of the fun. And I think that that's maybe what gets that is difficult with Christian movies is when it blurs the line between fantasy and reality in a way that not in the allegorical sense. I mean, that's one thing when you have something that is an exaggeration, like you said, of something that you really experienced. But when it's a made up miracle, and then they say, this miracle, now that you saw that happen on film, now do you believe? Now do you believe in Jesus? Do you still believe? And it makes it feel manipulative at that point for viewers, especially viewers who aren't believers or viewers like me who are skeptical of everything, to say, well, if I saw it happen in real life, not on film, then yeah, I would be like, well, that's interesting. That affects how I live my life moving forward. But if I, and not saying that like stories can't be real, but if it's exaggerated, does that make sense what I'm saying?
No, it does make sense. It's sort of like you're getting credit for a miracle that didn't happen. You're
yes.
like, believe
or
in
you're
God.
Giving, even
because
giving
this
God
is...
credit for a miracle that didn't happen.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. But then again, it's, you know, there's a miracle in every film. You know, the hero overcomes impossible odds, whether it's a Christian film or not. Mm-hmm. But you don't say, oh, I'm not feeling good about Bruce Willis at the end of Die Hard because it was all just made up.
Right,
you know,
but they're not asking me to join.
Change your life.
Like if they were doing the.
It was
Die
a Christmas
Hard,
movie.
It was a Christmas movie, yes. But if it was a recruitment video for special ops or for the police force or whatever, and they're like, if you join at the end, they're like, if you join the police, you'll get to run barefoot across glass just like Bruce Willis did. Then I would be like, well, that I would be thoroughly disappointed and feel a little bit tricked and feel a little disappointed at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the case of this film, My John, it's based on that passage, the passage at the end of the Gospel of John, I think it's 21, where Jesus is talking to Peter, the three feed my fish things. Mm-hmm. And Peter turns and says, well, what about him? To the beloved disciple who was John, and says, well, if I intend for him to stay until I return, what business of it is that of yours? You must do what, you're supposed to do. And so I just take that, which many people have over time, that John is still alive. What would John be doing today if he was living in 2005 Baltimore? And where would John been during the 1940s if he was a Jew in Europe? Mm. So I kind of look at the Holocaust from the perspective.
I appreciate those types of exploration stories. I think one thing, I recently reviewed the movie Breakthrough, and people were surprised at how positive I was about it. And that's
I was shocked
that by the people who make all those My Kid Died and Went to Heaven movies. But what I liked about it is the film understands that there are people who may not believe this thing. And I think that's what really blows my mind about some of these Christian movies, is that it feels like people involved in the movie can't imagine somebody not believing this thing and still being a decent human being. I think that's what makes the story not compelling. Like Unplanned, I think, is one of those movies that is just so uncompelling because you have such clear-cut good guys and bad guys, and it's not an exploration of a world. It doesn't take me to a world that I don't know about, like something as simple as a Planned Parenthood facility. I don't know about that world. Take me in and let me discover things with you, not tell me what to think about it. So I find all of the stories you're talking about compelling, the exploring spirituality and spiritual warfare and stuff. That's interesting. Exploring what if scenarios. What if John had lived through these moments in time? And that's an exploration. Some of these movies that I think I've been more defensive of the movie Heaven is for Real than I was Miracles from Heaven, because that at least tells a story of a family who thinks that this happened to their kid, rather than telling a story and saying at the end, you don't have faith if you don't believe this thing actually happened. And I think the reason why, for one, it's more compelling because it lets the audience discover things and makes the audience feel like they're discovering something new and seeing a world that they don't know. But it also leaves things up to interpretation, letting the audience feel like the movie is confident enough in what it has to say, that you and confident enough in you as a viewer that you can go home and think about it and read up more if you want. And that's okay. And maybe, just maybe, there's a being that these filmmakers believe in that will speak to the heart of the viewers. But sometimes as a Christian, I see these movies and I'm like, don't they believe in the Holy Spirit? Like, don't they believe that God can speak beyond their movie? And sometimes it feels like there isn't that belief.
Well, I just want to say, like, going back to the encounter, mm-hmm. and those 200 people coming forward.
Yeah.
Of course, I always tell the story, but I really can't take too much credit for it, because I wasn't the one who brought those people there.
Mm-hmm.
For these people to step forward, something's been working on them probably for years. You know, friends or their own thoughts and their own views of the world, So I'm just Jesus, maybe, as my wife said, I can't say, look at what an evangelistic guy
no,
I am.
No, but you're glad that you got to be a part of that.
No, I'm very happy to be a part of it.
And I agree. I mean, I think that that's great. I think that there's nothing wrong with bragging about things that God let you be a part of, because he didn't have to, and you got to be. And I think that's legitimate.
Well, I tell you, I do really think that there's a degree, and maybe less so a thought that the audience isn't smart enough to figure things out too.
I think maybe it's not so much that they think everyone, but they want to.
No,
play
I think they think everyone.
Oh, okay. I was trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. Yeah, like that idea that, well, yeah, but what if somebody walks away and doesn't get it? Then their blood
that
is on our hands.
That was the only chance they're going to get to see the gospel. God so loved them that he let their only chance was to see some Christian film that was made for $19,000 in someone's backyard.
When I saw David White punch that guy, I knew Jesus is my Lord and Savior.
Exactly.
But see, that's what's funny. That's the weird feeling that I have towards kind of the PureFlix world. And you could maybe fill in some of the gaps here, is that, and I won't keep you forever. I know we've been talking for a long time, but...
Oh, I'll talk all night about it.
I'll probably have you on again. Maybe I'll do like an audience asks you questions things, because okay. I bet they have stuff to ask.
They're going
to
get me sued, I
yeah,
think. Your
that's
audience,
the goal.
For sure. Well, you know, I was just got out of it. I was just in a witness in that Brad Stein, John Sullivan lawsuit against PureFlix over God's Not Dead.
We'll have to dedicate a whole podcast to that. Before you go, anything you want to plug? I mean, you mentioned your book.
Yes, I'd love to mention my book again. It's called Chapel Street. It's a paranormal thriller. It's about a man, Rick Backos, who straddles the line between sanity and insanity while battling a demonic force that has driven members of his family to suicide for generations. You know, I think it's very scary. I think it's very true, you know, to what it's like to be in that circumstance, though. It's, you know, because it's inspired by my family's own thing. It's inspired by practically everything in the book is inspired by something true, you know. So,
well,
but exaggerated.
It sounds really interesting. Where can people see it or find it?
Well, it is currently on pre-order on Amazon for the Kindle. I don't think the paperback's pre-ordered anywhere yet, and it's available for hardcover pre-order at Barnes and Noble.
Okay, well, great. Well,
I even ordered one.
I will put a link to that. I haven't ordered mine yet. I haven't pre-ordered
okay.
it. I will. I will put a link to that,
Kevin.
And I'll put a link to your blog in the show notes, and people can go and find you and read a lot more of the insights that you've given here today. All right, man. Well, thanks so much for coming on to the show, and you know what? We will talk very soon.